Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's September 11th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator that helps funded startups and enterprises conquer AWS. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules. So if you've been frustrated or found your team challenged with adopting Terraform and some of the best practices, do reach out. Just go to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and you'll book a meeting with me directly. All right, so how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Interrupt, engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Go to cloudposse.com/officehours, cloudposse.com/officehours to register. So if you do find any portion of today's office hours valuable, go ahead and share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse, and you'll find a recording of this session posted there in a few hours. All right, so without further ado, here are the news and announcements. See here, moving my windows around a little bit. Right, first one was something that I feel let down. Nobody told me about this CLI, and I don't know how it missed my radar. There have been a lot of CLIs for ECS over the years. A lot of them have been kind of like R&D skunk work projects by Amazon engineers. The one that is what I thought leading the race at least on this was the Amazon Copilot CLI, the AWS Copilot CLI. Now, this is not to be confused with the GitHub Copilot CLI or GitHub Copilot service. The Amazon Copilot is a service for declaratively managing your ECS task deployments with a modern CLI. Well, in the proverbial confusion that is Amazon and their services, they have another CLI. This one's called Amazon ECS CLI, kind of maybe like the EKS CTL, EKS Cuttle CLI for EKS. And what's really remarkable about this is that they support the Docker Compose format. Now, if you are familiar with Docker Compose, the subcommand of Docker, formerly a standalone CLI, it supported Docker Compose for a very long time. And in the past 12 months or so, they deprecated that support and it's no longer there. So that left a hole or a gap in my mind for simple deployments to ECS. And why I was so bummed about that was just when we were ready to re-implement our ECS CD solution with GitHub Actions, we were ready to start using that Docker Compose methodology because I thought that'd be really cool to have something familiar locally for test and development, as well as deploying to production or staging, or at the very minimum, deploying preview environments to ECS. Well, that wasn't really possible with Copilot. Plus, Copilot doesn't support Docker Compose. There are GitHub issues for AWS Copilot to support Docker Compose format. My guess is they're not going to add support if, hey, they have this first-class support for it here in this CLI. This repo is not new, it's very old, and I'm just really embarrassed that I'm the 1801th star on this repository and didn't know about it. That just goes to show my Googling foo sucks. So anyone using this, kick the tires on it. Have anything else to add? All right. There are many threads in SweetOps about the best way to meld Terraform with like CD, be it GitLab or GitHub Actions. If this is an interesting topic to you, check out the SweetOps Slack. Go to slack.sweetops.com or slack.cloudposse.com. They're the same thing. And you can find those threads there. All right. Next announcement. All right. So this one was brought to my attention. I was climbing this weekend, and a buddy of mine there, he used to work for Broadcom. He couldn't take it anymore. He just felt like they were ripping off too many customers, so he switched to Red Hat. But he was, and he's actually working on the side of the house that is probably going to be representing Terraform sales and so forth. He's helping sell Tanzu and Ansible and some of those products. Anyways, he brought this to my attention. I had missed it somehow, which is there's a company, Vertimove, that is another one of these patent troll type companies that seems to now be targeting a lot of the major cloud providers or technology providers who are leveraging open source, and that open source is violating supposedly a patent that they hold. They obviously should be going after. We develop a lot of open source. I don't say this lightly. I don't want them to be coming after us. But here's the deal: they can go after us all they like. It's not going to change the reality that they're going to get a pittance for that compared to suing the likes of IBM, HP, Google, and Amazon, of course. So they are suing those companies for the deep pockets that they have for violating patents. Violated by them as users of open source. So what IBM is, or sorry, yeah, what IBM is trying, or sorry, Red Hat is trying to do here is change the conversation that users of open source shouldn't be the ones getting sued for violating patents that the open source itself is breaking. Any thoughts on this one?
Well, a lot of the patent trolls, I'm sure people have seen this, are usually they patent a technology that has already been invented in the past, and that doesn't seem to matter with our courts, especially in East Texas. I wish, though, like this type of issue with the patent trolls would become a political policy for both parties. We push it up there and make it an issue, but probably is dwarfs in comparison, but this has been plaguing our industry for years, ever since they changed the laws and stuff like that to make them really hard to defend against these patent trolls.
I don't know. I've had a lot more positive impression on the movement, but I can't bring up specific cases or so forth. I guess my news is jaded by all the positive things I've seen come out of Cloudflare attacking the patent trolls and being victorious basically every time and suing the patent trolls out of existence. I was bummed not to see Cloudflare as one of the people here in the claim.
It's sad. Yeah. No, what I'm saying is like I'm glad that what Cloudflare did and this stuff, but I wish the laws could be changed because there was a change in our laws that opened the floodgates for this at one point. I forgot which administration came out of. I wish they could be reset back or something, you
Got
know.
it.
A lot of times what they do is they'll go after not so much the big companies, but they'll go after the middle tier. So for example, remember the Xerox one, like scanning your document PDF. There's a patent troll that sued basically anyone using the Xerox machine. And they could get money out of that because they go for the aggregate of companies that have money, but they don't have enough to defend themselves. And they're not small ones, they're like mid-sized companies.
Yeah, something needs to break when it relates to these patent trolls. It's just insane. And this happens to be about containerization. So my guess is any major deep-pocketed player leveraging Docker, Kubernetes, or similar technology is in the crosshairs.
Remember when hyperlinks, they were suing for hyperlinks as a patent?
No. Oh, hyperlinks? No, I don't remember that one.
So they as Eolus or something was suing Microsoft and Google and other companies for hyperlinking to something would be an object, metaphor type concept. The thing is before even the web, there was a thing called HyperCard from Apple that had hyperlinks in it. So the technology is, but the courts, of course, they're dumb. They're not technical people. They're like, well, that sounds good. And this was like tens of millions of dollars of lawsuits.
Did they win?
They actually did. But I
Really?
think that appealed and stuff like that. But it's going back and forth. I don't know what the last result is, but they'd lose and then they'd appeal and then they'd win and then it get appealed. So it's like
Yeah.
goes back and forth. But initially Microsoft paid a huge amount of money out on it. So
It's just it, I yeah I can't believe the attorneys that go up against these companies with their pockets and resources. It's gonna take some illusions of grandeur to win against this. But hey, I guess
I think
some
there's a
people want.
settlement, so they paid the troll off at a certain point. So
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just looking up now.
Yeah, I think containerization is too big to concede on. All right, next announcement. Let's see here. Don't want this
So I
thing.
sent a link to the one on the ELO list from Ars Technica. The conclusion of that one.
All right, the next announcement, shifting gears, is related to OpenTofu. As you know, OpenTofu, when the fork happened, I forget the timeline exactly of events, but very shortly after the fork happened, I believe the FAQ for the BSL on Terraform was updated or changed that made it against the terms of service by any non-HashiCorp product to use the Terraform registry. That was a defensive move that immediately made it so OpenTofu couldn't legitimately, any OpenTofu tool or CLI couldn't legitimately access the Terraform registry without breaking the terms of service. So they rapidly pushed out a open source registry for all the open source modules and providers out there to maintain compatibility with that. But it was very bare bones, right? It was basically based on flat files inside of a GitHub repository that were pushed to like an S3 bucket somewhere fronted by CloudFront. It was lacking a registry. So, everyone was kind of using the Terraform registry as a resource to find modules, but they had to use the Terraform registry for downloading. And that is no longer. Now you can go to register search.opentofu.org and use the new search provided by this. It's under active development, which is a good thing because it seems like the HashiCorp registry has all but stopped in development. A lot of the Cloud Posse readmes just don't work in the HashiCorp registry. They don't support admonitions yet. Relative links don't work. A lot of if you use a relative link, it's just going to link to a broken page on the HashiCorp registry. I hope these are some of the things that are going to address in this. It's still some of those faults are still in the OpenTofu registry. Like if I search for EKS here and go to, let me change this position here. So if I go to the EKS cluster module here, we see the admonition here is not properly rendered and we have some down below. I wish I remembered where we have relative links here, but I don't know an example right away here. Let's see if this one. Yep. Okay. So it has the same problems. I really think that they should just set the base URL of a page to be that of the module. And I think a lot of those relative links will just start working. All right. Next announcement is one. This was, what is it? Yeah, a week old or so. It's long been understood that Pulumi got its start by basically wrapping Terraform providers and enabling you to call those providers from your language of choice, be it, TypeScript, Python, Java, etc. What I didn't realize was I thought that support just, was basically using the RPC interface of plugins, so you could call any plugin from Pulumi. Well, I guess that was not the case because with this announcement, they're saying that they now support that you can basically use any provider with Pulumi. I have to say, for the past couple months, been doing a lot more development as we've been updating our documentation using DocuSaurus and our forthcoming marketing site using Next.js and React and Tailwind. And just how pleasant that experience is compared to using Terraform. And yeah, feeling some FOMO on the potential of Pulumi here, or seeing where it can fit in. We have a huge investment in Terraform and that whole ecosystem. I wonder what the world looks like where these two live together, without a contrived kind of way just to prove that they work together, but a beneficial way of leveraging both. Any thoughts on Pulumi? All right, tearing through these announcements. Let's see here. Someone shared, Michael shared an interesting link that the design for Homebrew, sorry, the design for the Terraform registry was inspired initially by Homebrew. Also, what's interesting is, Homebrew recently shifted to OCI for distributing the artifacts. So I wonder if they're going to start doing the same in OpenTofu pretty soon, because OCI is a much faster way to pull modules than Git. Anything to add to this, Michael? I know you were the one who shared it.
No, not really. I just thought it was an interesting read. I remember kind of when they put out the initial like request for people to talk about like different design ideas. There were a couple that came up, and this was the one that the steering committee went with. So I just thought it was kind of interesting. I like the layout of Homebrew, so I thought it was a good choice.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's yeah. All right. Yeah, I'm gonna read through that a little bit closer. I always like getting inspiration from how other open source projects are working. It wasn't on my radar. All right, next announcement is a minor one, just very brief. As OpenTofu adoption increases, we see more and more major corporations submitting their public keys. And what does that mean? Not much, but it's a it's the sentiment of it is a token, an indicator that they are using it internally in some capacity. So you can see this was submitted by a Microsoft employee, a Terraform provider, Azure public key. So that they can maintain their provider with signed binaries. So, any more announcements? Let's see here. Thanks, Joaquin, for sharing the link earlier on the patent troll saga with links.
It's the internet that almost wasn't.
I saw this morning that Terraform, I believe they released, I think it's 1.10 alpha, introducing a new feature, ephemeral values, which basically, yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Basically allowing you kind of like similar to sensitive, how you tag it as sensitive equal to true, you could do ephemeral equal to true. Which basically says, hey, don't store it in the state file. So it's just a piece of metadata that's attached with your inputs and your outputs that make it not be stored in state, which is pretty interesting. I was reading a little bit ago, one of my new favorite like Terraform blogs that I like reading is Martin Atkins, who's one of the core maintainers over there. He
He
has his
started a
own like,
blog?
yeah, he has his own development
Okay.
blog where he talks about different features. And so this ephemeral values, he kind of talks about the history of some of the issues that they've encountered over the years and like how his perspective on it has
Oh,
changed.
nice.
So yeah, it's a pretty good read.
You're holding out on
Yeah.
me with the good stuff. I'll add that to my reading list. That's a good one.
It's cool because it kind of just shows you the direction of some of the Terraform developments.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that is exciting. That can maybe help us to close a chapter in Terraform criticism around Terraform state and secrets.
Yeah, this article, I think he initially released it right after OpenTofu announced that they were going to be supporting state encryption. And so this was kind of a response saying, hey, we've thought about state encryption and it isn't the answer that we're looking for. We don't believe these values should even exist in state. And so this is kind of like his thoughts on that.
Yeah, I agree with both sides of it. I think Terraform had a, I think OpenTofu had a, another really strong argument for it that wasn't a consideration when I think Marty made that first post or announcement. Now, when you say this, I remember some of that. At the same time, you might recall there was a post about some security researcher coming out showing how you can modify the if you have access to modify the state file, you can cause infrastructure to get provisioned that isn't visible, I believe, in the plan file. And that was just evidence that why if you don't do encryption, you at least need a cryptographically signed state file for truly understanding if that file was tampered or not. Again, security in depth is just another layer. If you control the keys to this signing, then game's over anyways.
That's interesting.
Well, any other oh, I didn't see you posted that link so quickly. Any other were there any other posts on his development line?
They're not very frequent, so a couple of them are a little bit outdated.
Here he
Or
talks
not
about
out, yeah.
stack, their concept of it. It's just so funny how, yeah. Like, we didn't invent these terms, but it's pretty funny how HashiCorp basically took them wholesale after we used them this way. Atmos. All right. Any questions we can get answered today? RB, are you on the call today? Not seeing you right away here. Doesn't look like it. So RB had posted a kind of a question in the office hours channel. Which is something interesting. Michael, might be interesting for you too. I don't know if you saw the thread on that as well. I think it was in the contributors. If it was in contributors channel or somewhere else, I can't remember. So there is the OpenSSF project, which is establishing kind of transparency in your security practices, if you will. And one of the things it does is it has a scorecard. So you can get a scorecard for any repository and see how well it's following some of those best practices. Let me see if I can find the internal. Where was that? Yeah.
I do remember this thread. Shortly after seeing it, I went and actually implemented it, or like pulled it in and was using it on TerraMade.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I decided to go and give it a try, and it absolutely just blew up the repository for the one that's stood out was like pinned dependencies. It was saying that the dependencies weren't pinned very well, and so it hit me with like 35 security things. So
Yeah,
after
see.
that, I kind of was disheartened.
Yeah. But well, you weren't pinning, right? It was earned.
That's
No.
true.
But yeah, these things are interesting, and sometimes there are, reasonable reasons not to do that pinning. But this is kind of what this report looks like. This is on the Atlantis project, and it has branch protections, but no signed releases. Now with the GitHub Actions by GitHub for attestations, it makes it a lot easier to do those signatures. I wonder if this would meet that requirement there, for example. Anyways, this is something we're looking at rolling out at Cloud Posse across, just to showcase kind of all the best practices that we have across our organizations and some of the precautions that we take. The thing I was kind of hoping that there would be like a image, like a skyscraper banner or image banner that you could kind of use, so you could embed this into README's to kind of show off what you're doing.
I think they have a badge, but it
They do have
might just be
a badge.
a
It's very
generic.
basic.
Yeah,
Yeah.
just a generic.
Yeah, they have a standard GitHub build badge, looks like this. So it's passing your score, and if you're passing or failing, kind of. Oh yeah, you guys see my screen, right? I'm not sharing the wrong window, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So has anyone checked out Stacklock Minder for open source maintenance? I've never heard of the project. Anybody heard of Stacklock? Is Stacklock the company behind OpenSSF, or is OpenSSF truly a foundation? Well, that was that. Any other conversations we can have today? Any questions? So Florian in the chat is asking, this is taking a step back to what Michael was talking about with the Terraform 1.10 alpha about ephemeral values. So this is a good question. I'm going to talk about it more broadly. So Florian asks, so I'm assuming OpenTofu will be unable to support ephemeral values because of the new Terraform licensing. No, not at all. So this is the thing, and it's going both ways. They are not allowed to use the code that is BSL licensed in HashiCorp Terraform, but they can re-implement the interface. They can re-implement it conceptually without, the assistance of looking at that code. So OpenTofu has a lot of strict processes that they follow, so they don't, accidentally introduce any proprietary code into that code base. And I bet this is something that OpenTofu is considering. There's got to be a thread on it somewhere. Everything is very transparent with OpenTofu. If you go to the organization and the discussions, they have RFCs there. There's probably one which is addressing ephemeral values, but I haven't looked. Let's see here.
So, Darius, can I have a question? Wait.
Yeah, Darius, go ahead.
Hello, Jim. Yeah, so I actually have my colleague here as well as human. We work on a project to actually save costs of RDSS in AWS, which are inactive. So, as we all know, if you have a snapshot database, like, the terabytes, AWS charge you for the full size of snapshot, even if it's not, if it's half of this only utilized. So, we actually, someone actually creating a
GitHub Action job to make a dump, pg dump to the RDS to S3. Just wondering if anyone did something similar or found a way to actually save costs of a database which basically inactive for like say weeks or even months, and reasonable size, so then you don't want to keep a snapshot and restore it because then it's still cost a lot.
Can you clarify though, or I miss maybe I misheard. What I thought I heard you say was every snapshot costs the same as what the whole database is, which is not my understanding. It's only you pay for the base snapshot and then the incremental differences between snapshots is my understanding about how it was charged.
Yes, yeah, but but in our scenario, we just even need one. We don't need incrementals because, like, databases, for example, down for like 2 months, let's say, or 3 months. So we really just need one. But because it's like, let's say 100 terabytes, this still 100 terabytes cost a lot of money. But because it takes, so it's compressed quite well. So if we do pg dump and gzip it, then we pay tenth of that price. And I can see another option to do that kind of saving. Using native AWS tools. Looks like a lay they on purpose try to, sucks money from you.
Yeah, I mean, there is that, but there's also just I don't know. We struggle with this at Cloud Posse a bunch. Like, you have things that you do when you have to be incredibly cost conscious at the low end. You're trying to, instead of spending $100 a month for the backups, you're trying to spend $1 a month for the backup, right? $100 is a lot depending on your company. But when your bill on Amazon is $100,000 a month, that $100 doesn't even show up, right? That's a rounding error. So the larger your infrastructure, the harder it is. The other thing is the practical realities of that snapshot. Like if it is a 100 terabyte, backup or whatever, that is, going to take ages to restore from a PG dump. You're going to have to scale up a database massively to restore any larger type of backup that was through PG dump. So they're diminishing kind of returns with it, and that this is where suddenly it becomes a very specific solution. What I mean is it may work for you if you have the XYZ trade-offs and you are accepting of the risks, but if you're not accepting of that, then you better go with the standard AWS snapshots that permit. I mean, there's so much built into that that you also get as well, the ability to use AWS vaults with that and the ability to do cross-region replication of those and the integrations within the UI and all of that you're forsaking when you go the route of using an S3 bucket. But that's just my take. Has anyone experienced with some maybe Lambdas or other helpers that facilitate these PG dumps basically of a database? The only other justification I could see is that it's great if you also want to do cross cloud backup, you want to stash one of those over in GCP just in case.
Yeah, true. Then it will just still work. And at the moment, how we achieve that is using GitHub Actions, and they have a 1 hour. So we have a, like runner, just simple standard Linux machine. We install pg dump on it, and then run it. Just the only problem is like 1 hour limit. So if it's over 1 hour, then we'll have to think about either running parallel, having faster runner to be able to achieve it within an hour.
Isn't the 1 hour limit only if there's no output for 1 hour? I mean, if there's output, I think it can run longer than an hour.
I'm aware actually it's a 1 hour hard limit, at least I've seen it. There's no wasn't, but maybe but that's what
That
I'm
could be
aware now
another
it's one
interesting
limit.
thing.
Yeah, but then there's a parallel option for the pg dump or basically coming. Yeah, we try to make still experimenting, that's why I'm asking what our plan is to also have the restore job to at the end run the GitHub action to restore to make sure it fully worked before we delete it from a snapshot. Yeah.
Looks like it's a 6 hour limit.
All right. Okay. Maybe it's something put on our organization for this 1 hour. Yeah. So people are conscious of their actions on GitHub
Yeah.
actions. Because initially we thought to actually spin the Fargate cluster to do that job in the batch mode or something to then kill it. But that could be overkill. That's how we're just going at the moment with GitHub Action. Yeah, just
So,
that way. Like saying for the big organization, probably you don't worry. And this is like a quite specific case where you don't need database for a couple months.
yeah, I can understand that way.
But maybe also use case scenario where you think may not need database and you want to keep it, but you just want to have it, you know, with this very cheap storage, nearly like a tape in old days, and an AWS Glacier. But on a snapshot, you cannot, there's no tiering. There's export to S3, but we try to, there is no restore from S3 because when you export to S3, you can only query it with Athena. There's no really way, it's one way.
So when you export to S3, it isn't in a standard like pgdump format.
No, it's Sparky, Sparky
It's on
format.
Parquet. Yeah.
Parquet, yeah, and there's no restore for that. The only way to, you can query with it, Athena. But no restore it back. We, at least we couldn't see it, find it.
That's interesting. Yeah, it makes me wonder.
I wonder if people who have experience with Azure or GCP, whether wondering how it looks on the different worlds, whether they are more user friendly in this scenario. It's the same story. Yes.
It is pretty remarkable that they support exporting this way but not importing. Oh well. Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, so someone else was sharing. Mark, I was sharing this link. Let's see here. This is if you never remember the names of AWS API calls, this is helpful. So there's a total. This is like the Cartesian product or something. There's 17,000 different types of AWS permissions.
I sent a second link. You can try that one. It has a more useful look to it.
Interesting. Thank you. Sure.
Permissions reference for AWS Classic One. Yeah, that's helpful when you're working on it. So, any
Mostly
other?
for designing policy statements.
Yeah, exactly.
About another question, if I may, so,
Yeah, go for it.
about the Liquidbase and Aurora in AWS. When anyone had the experience using Liquidbase for database revisions, but with Aurora, at the moment use it successfully with standard RDS to basically just either update schemas or just change anything database, but have a problem with Aurora. But,
I know it's come up previously on office hours as a recommendation or suggestion. I don't recall hearing any negatives with it, but it's always one of these questions. At what time does it run in your pipeline? If you're using Kubernetes, is it an init job? If you're using GitHub Actions, should it run before your deployment or after your deployment? What happens if you do a rollback? All those questions. Anyone have experience with Liquibase they'd like to share? All right. I saw somebody raise their hand or what was.
it
Oh.
was me. Oh, okay, so sorry.
Oh.
Florin is okay. Florin is
Oh.
raised.
Yeah, well, you go first. Florian asked the earlier question. Go for
Okay,
it.
so, we talked about AWS Copilot, and I saw an alternative before from HashiCorp called Waypoint.
Yeah.
Did you know about it? And I
Oh
don't know
yeah.
if I
So
anyone has used before.
we talked about Waypoint recently, actually. It was very interesting because Waypoint was, I think, one of the last products that graced Hashimoto's hands before he kind of moved into other internal projects and was gearing up for his departure from HashiCorp. Waypoint was this product that was launched at that time in this very ambiguous manner where they refused to label it anything associated with things that we use today. They wouldn't call it CI, they wouldn't call it CD, they wouldn't call it anything other than like, it's some developer experience platform or tool or something. Well, this is interesting because this came up in the last 2 weeks or so on office hours, and we looked into it at that time, and the HashiCorp platform now has Waypoint as a service, as an internal developer platform. So they finally decided to label it. Okay, internal developer platform. Now I can kind of understand its position. But where it got its roots was very different because HashiCorp started it as an open source project like everything else that they have. And look, it was archived. So they abandoned it as an open source project. So that's interesting. And they've just made it strictly a commercial one. So what is Waypoint? Well, I don't know what Waypoint is as part of HCP, but what Waypoint was honestly something in whatever category you call Dagger, Dagger HQ or Earthly, Waypoint was in that category. Slight, different feature set, but it enabled, a consistent way of describing your build, test, and deploy so that you can abstract that away from your CI and CD system, have it work locally the same way it works remotely, and then just call those commands from your CI. So that's the extent of my understanding. Did you have a more specific or pointed question on it?
No, but in my previous job, I used AWS Copilot to my task with it was like the company was migrating their stack from GCP to AWS, and I used AWS Copilot to do that. It was fantastic, and it helped me a lot on that. But I have a little problem with it. It's like it doesn't leverage the AWS Lightsail. We used to have some resources to put it there because we like the model of Lightsail. But during my research, I found there is a project called FISA. I don't know. I will send you the
Oh,
link.
what?
Yeah, I'll send you the link. It's an Arabic word. It's I think the tool is leveraging the Lightsail. Is doing somehow. I mean, like it's a small project. But yeah, he's trying to leverage the Lightsail instead of deploying on ECS or stuff like that.
Got it. So
I didn't try it that.
are you saying he's basically creating the Copilot-like experience, but
Yes, yes,
fail?
yeah. And he tried to leverage some templates like deploying a Ghost platform or deploying an RDS ready. Yeah, but I didn't try it, but just saw his work, and yeah. His work is a little
I
bit
mean,
old
this is
because
not like an
he's
updated from
leveraging
2 years,
CloudFormation.
but
Okay.
this, I mean, yeah, but this project is abandoned, no updates for 2 years. I wouldn't even touch it. Were you on the call earlier today when I talked about Copilot briefly and also about ECS CLI tool? Did
I
you
saw this yesterday.
Try this ECS CLI before you tried Copilot? Just curious.
Nope. I saw it before, but I wasn't like because to be honest, because I was like more interested of migrating the whole stack from database and leveraging secrets and doing a lot of things, and I think this tool doesn't do that. doesn't
Yeah, very specific to just.
doesn't have add-ons like Copilot. Copilot has add-ons, so that's make it more interesting. And that tool is wasn't, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting to position it. Florian, can we get to your question?
Yeah, hey. I kind of very recently noticed something in Terraform which I actually didn't notice before. And I was just kind of wondering if this is kind of an open secret in the Terraform community and that if that was something for me completely new and I kind of completely missed it.
Sure.
But I noticed that when I have a look at directly after creating basically fresh resources, AWS resources with Terraform, that there are quite a lot of AWS resources which are having missing fields in the state file. And that's kind of revealed if you run after fresh apply, if you run a plan refresh only. And one of the kind of very simple examples is if you start an EC2 instance and then assign Elastic IP to it, then basically the AWS instance is completely missing out on that a new public IP is getting assigned. So it's actually having in, if you look in the state file, it has the IP address, basically its old initial IP address it got started with, and not the new IP address, which is coming from the Elastic IP. And so obviously this is something you can, so I looked in dependencies, but even dependencies don't really fix that. And when I started to look into kind of other cases and other modules, so for example, the Cloud Posse VPC module, then this is also happening with routes, with gateways, and they're basically there are fields missing. I found on the GitHub, so in the issue list for the Terraform provider, AWS provider, I found at least four open bugs, and which basically the first one, I guess, has the number 31. So this is actually pretty old. So this is all open. And I found a discussion on the HashiCorp discussion channel, which basically said that this is was originally kind of a misdesign, and it has been never fixed, and that this might be fixed with the plugin framework too. But yeah, so I was kind of wondering if other people have noticed this as well, and if this is kind of an open secret that basically, the AWS provider at its current state seems to be broken for these kind of things.
I think it might just be so what I thought you were going to say was slightly different. And but I get your point. And I guess there's a few ways of approaching it or looking at it. There's looking at it from the end user perspective, and then I think I definitely agree with what you're saying, like these seem to be bugs. And then there's looking at it from the developer perspective and kind of understanding how, the underlying interfaces and what is there. I'm wondering, I can't attest to this for a fact, but I'm wondering if it's more or less just a reflection of the raw responses from the APIs. And looking at our like implementation for the EC2 instance, we handle the case you're talking about, like if an EC2, if an EIP is assigned, then we use that. Otherwise, we have the default IP of the instance. And my guess is it, they're both right. It's just that one works and one isn't. One is the one it was established with versus one is the current one. And you can reattach. You can have more than one EIP. Can't, yeah, you can have multiple EIPs, no, per instance, or am I totally wrong?
You can, I think, yeah, so you should be able to attach, I think it's up to 15, 16 network interfaces, and then you can have different EIPs. But the thing I was surprised of is that the state file itself is reporting that it has, so it's wrong.
But if it's a one-to-many relationship, I mean, how can it report the IP if you can have multiple IPs. It's really you got
No,
to make.
it's a one-to-one relationship. It's just simply that the EC2 instance comes first up, technically, so first comes up with another public IP, because the subnet automatically assigns a new IP address to it, and then when you just do the association with the Elastic IP, then this is changing. But
Yeah.
there are also there are other examples too, and this is the one I kind of really went through step by step by basically downloading the state file before and after doing an apply refresh only, and you can re actually see that there are a couple of fields are changing, and they are simply it kind of seems that the AWS provider never really does a refresh at the end. So it's basically it doesn't wait till the state on AWS is completely settled, and then it doesn't reread the state and writes the correct state down. It basically has an intermediate state, which then gets written down, and then when you do a refresh only, then at this point you notice that the state in the cloud actually is different to the
That's
one which
exactly.
is in
Huh.
the file.
So you're saying basically there's basically always drift after the first apply of a resource with an EIP.
Yes. I have a minimal example because I couldn't believe that this is consistent. But even with the latest AWS provider, I have this as a consistent problem. And if you actually do the standard Cloud Posse VPC module, you will actually notice that it's not only the ERPs, it's also the routes. And the gateways, there are also fields which are they're even completely
Well then,
fields which are missing.
okay, because I was going to say the NAT gateways we assign an EIP, so that would explain that the problem extends to the NAT gateways. Okay, interesting.
And like I said, there are right now there are about 4 bugs which are currently or 4.